You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
Physical, philosophical. I said, do you have any music about getting philosophical? This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and let's get philosophical today. We're going to take up the idea of philosophy and how it can be applied by all of us to our modern predicament, and not just reading Kant and Augustine and Nietzsche, but thinking about current predicaments and experiences as well. And hey, by the way, maybe finding some people of color and women to read in addition to the white male canon. Next week, Burlington hosts its second annual Public Philosophy Week. So we're taking that bait. Joining me to explore the idea of philosophy in 2018 are two philosophy professors, Terrence Cuneo from UVM and Kenny Walden from Dartmouth. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for playing along with my Olivia Newton-John joke. Appreciate it. At least I got a smile here in the studio from Terrence. Appreciate
Delighted
that.
To be here. Thank you.
So I really don't mean this as some unanswerable question, but in very concrete terms, Professor Walden, what is philosophy?
Oh, well, you say very concrete terms. That makes it hard.
All right. Well, go right ahead then.
I think a lot of fields are raise questions and possibilities for criticism. And for most of those fields, be they any kind of human endeavor like the sciences or medicine or law or government, some of those questions are kind of closed off. If you ask those questions, you've kind of attacked the foundations of the endeavor you're involved in, and for that reason, you've left that endeavor. So if you're doing science and you start asking questions about, oh, but what do you mean by electron? What kind of thing is an electron? Is this something we can really know about? Once you start asking those questions, you've, at least on one way of thinking, left physics and entered philosophy. So philosophy you can think of as the discipline that picks up these sort of long trains of questions and forms of criticism that might be closed off by more regimented fields that are more directly relating to, say, empirical phenomenon or problems out in the world.
Terrence, you want to pick up that thread?
Oh, I think that was a beautiful explanation. Yeah. Someone described philosophy as thinking in slow motion. That's not a bad way of doing it either. It's people thinking very hard about difficult questions and doing it with a lot of care and imagination, when it's done well, at least. Yeah.
Are there answers in philosophy or only questions?
Well, I would say there are lots of answers. They're not always the easiest to arrive at, however. So this is something that we try to get straight with in an undergraduate philosophy, intro to philosophy class. Okay, difficult questions. Does it mean that they don't have answers? No. I would say that most of them have answers, and these answers are not due to our devising or anything of that sort. But they're complicated, they're abstract, they're difficult, so we have to think very carefully about them. And it's not always clear what the answers are.
What got you interested in studying philosophy?
Well, for me, it was more or less love at first sight. I took a class as a sophomore in college on political philosophy. I still remember it so vividly. And I thought to myself, my goodness, these are the questions I've been asking myself. And I didn't know there was this discipline that was talking about this. And so after that, I was more or less hooked.
Why? What did you think you were going to study?
I was leaning towards political science myself. This was a class in political philosophy, and I realized that, oh, yeah, these questions about justice and so forth and were the real questions that were on my mind. Yeah.
Kenny Walden, what about for you? What got you interested in studying philosophy?
So, and my answer to your first question might have suggested this way of thinking about things, but I was always really taken by the foundations of things. I always wanted to get to the bottom rung of the ladder. So when I was in high school and my early days in college, I studied math and gradually got more interested in the foundations of math and in questions about logic. And that gradually led me into the philosophy of mathematics. And from there, just into philosophy more generally, and I found out, oh, this is the place where people who really want to get to the bottom of things spend their time.
Take me into the world of the philosophy of mathematics a little bit, Kenny.
Oh, so I should mention that I'm not really a specialist in the philosophy of mathematics now. That was a much younger version of myself. But so mathematics raises a lot of interesting questions. A fairly obvious one is that mathematics seems to deal with entities like numbers and sets and geometric forms that don't have a lot of the properties that we usually associate with entities. So they're not concrete. We can't touch them. They don't exist in space and time, it seems. The number 2 didn't come into existence. It doesn't exist at a particular point in space or time. And this leads a lot of people to question whether these things really exist and whether or not mathematics can do without them somehow. And if they do exist, whether their existence is of a variety different from the existence of tables and chairs and atoms and molecules. So that's one question that philosophers of math are interested in. Another one is how we come to know things about mathematics, whether it's about these curious objects or whether it's about structures that are common to lots of different parts of the world. Whether there's a sort of special access that we have to the mathematical realm.
It's fascinating. That's fascinating to me because I do often think of mathematics as I sort of picture it as concrete. Well, 2 + 2 = 4. We're not questioning that. So it's really interesting to hear you talk about that. Anne is on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, Jane. Parenthetically, one of my favorite Frenchmen is Voltaire, right after my son-in-law. But anyway, my question is, do you consider Shakespeare, Hamlet's soliloquy to be or not to be a profound philosophical discussion, question, posit, whatever? And if so, I think it's one of the most beautifully written pieces.
And Anne, before you go, do you see it as a valid philosophical question to be or not to be?
Sure. And you know what? Put light. I'm 85, Jane. No, I don't sound it, but I am. And layer over that the thing we're having with the dignity of death conversation. You know, I know that Hamlet was the young, agonized romantic, but you know. The sea of troubles that I'm facing is physical deterioration and so on and on and on.
Anne, wow, I appreciate you jump-starting this conversation and taking us there. Professor Cuneo, what do you think?
it's I would say a crystallization of a host of different issues that arise when we start thinking about our own existence and what it means to keep going and why we ought to keep going. And philosophers have had a lot to say about these sorts of things.
Did I hear a but in the way you said, yeah?
Well, it's Shakespeare. So it's going to require a bit of work on our part to unpack exactly what the character is getting at and what sorts of questions are lying beneath the statement. So what exactly it comes to doesn't wear its meaning on its face. It's going to take some interpretation. Hmm. Yeah.
Professor Walden?
I think there's probably this is a very philosopher-style answer. There are probably two ways to answer it. There's a very ecumenical conception of philosophy where, yes, by all means, the soliloquy raises all kinds of important philosophical questions. The work has lots of philosophical insights that are conveyed in a nuanced and really incisive way. So, it's philosophy. On the other hand, it's probably worth understanding philosophy as having a distinctive set of tools that it uses, that it proceeds by argumentation rather than a dramatic narrative, that it's really interested in clarity and rigor for the most part, rather than in some of the aesthetic virtues that we associate with Shakespeare. And in that way, I think we would think of Hamlet not as being a work of philosophy in the way that Treatise of Human Nature or The Critique of Pure Reason are works of philosophy, but a work of art that's really philosophically important but ultimately doing something else or at least proceeding by slightly different methods.
You know, Anne also brought us to that question of today, thinking about some of the ethical considerations that go into our approach to dying. and to dying well and what that means, and is physician-assisted suicide or death with dignity, as it's called, depending on your position, is that appropriate? Does that get us into some of the territory that might benefit from a philosophical approach when we think about modern issues that we're facing, Kenny Walden?
I would say so. Yeah, I think one thing that happens immediately when you start thinking about physician-assisted suicide is you start asking questions about, well, why is it good for me to go on living at all? I mean, for someone who's relatively young like me and enjoys this life, why is that good? Why would it be wrong for me to end someone else's life? What is the value of a life in general, and what kind of demands does that value place on other people? And part of what philosophers do is trying to fit an answer to a specific question like, is physician-assisted suicide morally permissible, into a larger systematic web of answers to similar questions that might not appear directly related at first blush, but once you start thinking about the deeper issues, become relevant.
So Terence Cuneo, it takes us it's not just ethics when we talk about philosophy in the modern world. We're not just talking about the study of ethics, because often, you know, thinking about medical ethics can get you into a very philosophical territory, but there is a distinction between just ethics and philosophy.
The way I think philosophers typically think about the issues is that moral philosophy or ethics is a subfield within philosophy. And then within ethics or moral philosophy, we have various subfields themselves. And one subfield concerns the foundations of ethics, talking about such things as whether there are any moral truths or moral facts and how we might know them. Another subfield will talk about the principles of right action, what they are, what makes actions right. And then yet another subfield will tackle really sticky, difficult questions such as physician-assisted suicide or the moral permissibility of abortion or whether we ought to be eating animals. And these subfields interact in various sorts of ways and feed off each other in various sorts of ways. But it's all open territory for philosophers thinking about these issues.
You know, I mentioned some fairly famous philosophers, and when I took a philosophy class in college, I really enjoyed it. But I do remember that most of the texts we read were from rather ancient European scholars, a lot of white men. Are there ways, Kenny, to study philosophy that take into account other worldviews? Because, I mean, of course, as with any field, the questions and the dogma are shaped by the experiences of the people in power, the people who are saying this is what the field is. So I'm curious about bringing other perspectives into the study of philosophy.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is something that's been recently a concern of philosophers themselves, is trying to make the field more liberal and more inclusive. And there have been a number of things that philosophers have been interested in as part of that. And one is trying to bring in other cultural perspectives on philosophy. And there's a burgeoning field of comparative philosophy. In particular, people now find it very profitable to read ancient Greek philosophy alongside classical Chinese philosophy. Another issue was just getting in the present day more women and minorities into philosophy, and there are a number of programs that are aimed at doing that. And certainly, there are still many problems and obstacles that remain, but the field looks a lot different than it did, say, at the beginning of the 20th century.
Hmm. Do you agree with that, Professor Cuneo? I mean,
yeah.
Does it when you see students who are attracted to philosophy, are you seeing students of color? Are you seeing women who feel like this is a field for them?
Yeah, we are. I do see that. I think there's a long-standing issue here about the field being relatively inhospitable to women, for example, and they're not seeing it somewhere they can make a career and find their home in. But I think there are positive forces at work here, and we're seeing the boundaries beginning to open up a lot more. And the nice thing about philosophy is, as Kenny mentioned in his opening remarks, that well, the boundaries are wide. So if you want to talk about issues that are of special relevance to people who have certain kinds of experiences because of their background and sex and gender, whatever it might be, philosophers are ready to take up those questions and to think about them carefully. So there's a great deal of openness in that regard, that just about nothing's off limits.
Yeah. Let's on this go to Miriam, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Miriam. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, where are all the new philosophers? We, you know, you tend to focus mainly on the old ones, Plato, Socrates, et cetera, but I'm wondering, where are the new ones? So isn't philosophy something that grows? I mean, can it grow with the times? Can there be new questions that could be, you know, analyzed and evaluated and put into a philosophical spectrum? And so that's my question.
Miriam, have you looked for any of these scholars? Are you actively searching and not finding them, or just curious?
Yeah, I am. You know, I really like a philosophy, and I've almost always thought of myself as a philosopher on some level, you know, asking the questions, you know, being thoughtful and things of that nature. So, yeah, and I would like to see newer versions of, you know, or newer philosophers to read and that are more up to date, up to the times, perhaps, and have more of a connection with the new ones. I know the old ones have their standards. There's a lot to learn from them, but
where are the new ones? And Miriam, let me take that and put it to Kenny Walden. Do you have names that you could recommend to Miriam to read?
Terence Cuneo, an excellent new philosopher. His work is very distinguished. So I say that kind of in jest, but I mean the answer is that I think most people who work in philosophy departments think of themselves as philosophers and doing much the same thing that people like Aristotle and Descartes and Hume and Kant did. And they might not be as famous and they might not be as good, though that second one is certainly debatable for a lot of people, but they're up to the same kinds of questions. And those philosophers like the ones I mentioned will always loom large because ours is a field that's rooted in its history. But I think everyone thinks of themselves as pushing forward and trying to make progress on the same questions that have been asked for a long time. So if Miriam is interested in particular sorts of questions that philosophers have taken up, I think she can probably find contemporary writers dealing with a lot of those questions.
Any suggestions other than yourself, Terence?
Well, it's interesting to hear people from the outside speak about their own take on what's going on. From the inside, philosophy seems to me a very vibrant, interesting discipline with a lot of different voices and a lot of different people saying very interesting things and pushing a lot of the discussions forward in ways that I think are really helpful. But I think it does remain true that most of us have our jobs in universities, and the system is set up in such a way that in order for professors to get tenure, writing for the general public is not something that is going to help you very much. In fact, it might even hurt you. So there's a sense in which we philosophers aren't trained to be writing for the general public and aren't directing a lot of our work at the general public because of the way things are set up. And I think some of that needs to be rethought. I think some of us need to start directing our attention to the general public. But I would certainly mention people like Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago, specialist in ancient philosophy, but it's also made remarkable contributions with regard to writing about the university and education and the law, all sorts of different things. So I'm thinking of Sally Haslinger at MIT, again, making really distinctive contributions in philosophy of gender and political philosophy and so forth. So yeah, there are wonderful people doing terrific work.
There's a hashtag I follow on Twitter that's SciComm, so science communication. It sounds like maybe you guys need a FICOM or something to talk about how to take what you're doing in the academic fields and then apply it to a, sort of a more general public so that there is this accessibility and people understand the work. And I know that's a big topic of conversation in the science communities and maybe starting to be one in philosophical communities as well.
Yeah. So our discipline, like the sciences, tends to get – very specialized, very technical. We're writing for one another and trying to get as clear as possible on the issues. And that does mean that a lot of the discussion becomes relatively inaccessible. But Philosophy Week, which my colleague Tyler Doggett has spearheaded, is one attempt among many to get people thinking along with us and on about some of the topics that interest them and interest philosophers. Yeah, there are movements afoot.
We got a note from Carla who says, despite what Jane said about encouraging diversity in philosophy, both of today's commentators are men, I think. How come? And I will say we actually did reach out to several women who are philosophers for today's show, but it turns out Tuesday at noon seems to be a time that a lot of philosophers are actually teaching, so they weren't available or they were out of state. But I take your point, Carla, and appreciate it. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're contemplating philosophy and its role in modern life. We're talking with UVM philosophy professor Terence Cuneo and Dartmouth philosophy professor Kenny Walden. And Emma says, my question is there only one God, or are there many of them? My understanding of them is there are many for different beliefs. If you take the Greek gods, for example, people would go to these gods because they helped them with ways to cope with tragedies, happiness, health, and other different things. Now, I don't know if Emma is actually asking for your personal take on this, Professor Walden, but what do you think about that question and how to approach it?
Well, first thing to ask, again, to answer a question with a question, I say, well, what are you looking for in a god? Or more precisely, what's your concept of a god? So what kind of thing are you – is your are your questions about God answering to? So I think there are some natural pressures towards monotheism. I mean, assuming that there is a god at all, you would think that, well, God should be somehow unifying or complete or total, and these concepts all point to there being one God. On the other hand, if you don't associate the divine with those kinds of concepts, then yeah, you might be happy to have a concept of God that's more attached to particular niches in your life. It depends on what you're looking for.
Terence, engage.
Yeah, that seems to me right. I think we could probably make a distinction between God or gods, little g, and God with a big G. And when we're talking about God with a big G, we're talking about ultimate reality. And a lot of philosophers will think of this ultimate reality as being a perfect being, a being greater than which none can be conceived. Whereas the little g gods would be something much less than big G God, if big G God exists. Yeah.
We got a note from Jeff who says, I am super stoked about this show. I got my BA in philosophy from St. Michael's College and now work in the beer and wine industry in Vino Veritas, right? I try to use my platform to engage folks in philosophical discussions frequently. In 2015, I wrote a column for the Burlington Free Press and coincidentally am publishing a new beer and philosophy column this Friday. In addition, my podcast episode, It's the Beer Talking, this week is also on philosophy. And Jeff says there are a lot of brewers in Vermont who are students of philosophy. Sean Hill at Hill Farmstead, Paul Saylor of Zero Gravity, and Christopher Rockwood of Magic Hat, just to name a few.
Wow.
So, what is it, do you think, Kenny, about alcohol and philosophy?
Well, a lot of good thought has been done over good beer, so at least there's that connection.
We also got a note from Paul in Warren who says, I once knew a guy who was a professor of philosophy. When my wife asked him what he was working on, his succinct reply was, you wouldn't understand. And when I asked him whether after 2,000 years philosophers were getting any closer to having things figured out, i.e. having answers instead of just more questions, he said, we're working on it. I had to laugh, but it sounds like that might still be the case. Kenny Walden, it sounds like, yes, that's the case because that's partly what philosophers are trying to do is to go deep and have those questions, not wrap it all up in a neat little bow. Would that be correct?
I think that's right. I think philosophers disagree about whether or not philosophy makes any progress. And something they disagree about is what it would mean for philosophy to make progress. So one way of thinking about it is that there's a set of questions, and those questions have objectively correct answers, the way that you might think that whether or not there is a beer in the fridge has an objectively correct answer, and that philosophy will be done when it has those answers. That way of thinking thinking about progress is probably not adequate to what philosophy is up to. But once you set that aside, what's left over? Is it just sort of this Sisyphean struggle that you're, you know, constantly trying to push the rock up the hill and sliding back down? Or is there some way to say, oh, well, you know, we don't have the answers exactly, but we now understand the questions better, or we have better tools for answering the questions. Those are the standards I think philosophers who believe that the discipline can make progress rely on.
We have another more pointed question from Don in West Rutland, who says, I'm curious where and how you might find interesting connections to the area of quantum physics and cosmology. Do the questions of whether time exists or whether there is life on other planets connect to philosophical inquiry about the nature of reality or the purpose of life on Earth? And Kenny, I'm going to toss this back to you to start.
Well, so one place you can look if you're interested in connections between quantum mechanics and philosophical questions is the work of one of my colleagues, Peter Lewis, who's an expert on quantum ontology. That is, what we should infer about the basic nature of the world given the curious and peculiar results of quantum physics. It seems that it teaches us that a lot of our standby assumptions about how the world is structured are probably wrong. And what we should replace it with, however, is less clear. So that's one place to look, and I would say that if you're looking for philosophers who are working on the cutting edge, Peter is one of them.
That's fascinating. I wanted to ask you about a particular moment for philosophy in the recent presidential political swirling system. So during the Republican primary in 2015, Marco Rubio famously said in one debate, quote, "Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers." Now, my main complaint with that was a grammatical one, but I imagine for philosophers, you know, this was not quite the way you wanted to be represented on the national stage. So, Terrence, what did it feel like to be called out in that way?
Yeah, it felt as if it was an articulation of an uninformed viewpoint. So I suppose the question I would ask in response to the statement is something like, look, do you want people, citizens, who are careful in their thinking or analytically astute or creative in their thinking? And if you do, you should want there to be people who are philosophically trained, who have got the best sort of training for the mind that one can get. And it seems to me that we don't have enough of such people. Yeah.
Well, did you also see that Marco Rubio came back around to that exact point of view? He tweeted out just recently sort of an apology. He said, I made fun of philosophy 3 years ago, but then I was challenged to study it, so I started reading the Stoics. I have changed my view on philosophy, but not on welders. We need both vocational training for workers and philosophers to make sense of the world. So do you feel vindicated
that sounds,
now?
That sounds a lot better.
So, you know, we're talking here today partly because we have this hook of Public Philosophy Week. It's the second annual Public Philosophy Week in Burlington. And Kenny Walden, when you think about this idea that we've been swirling around for much of the program about how to make philosophy accessible, how to translate to people that philosophy is happening and philosophical thought is important, it's important to be learning about, it's important to be engaging in, do you see philosophy sort of being treated or taken the way it should be as people think about things like whether they want to be a welder or a philosopher?
I'm not sure because I haven't spoken to enough people, I think, about how they make their decisions. I think that probably speaks to a certain deficiency amongst at least one philosopher. But I'd say I think that everyone could probably stand to have some more of these tools that we've spoken about and some more of the background theoretical resources to think about the choices that they're making in their lives in ways that puts it in the context of other choices that other people might be making, of other choices they might make later in their life. And I think philosophy is really just trying to do that in an organized way, or at least parts of philosophy, ethics, and thinking about practical reason, are just trying to take those sorts of choices that people face and how they might make them and put them in a unified and coherent framework. So insofar as you might think it would be helpful to see how other people have thought about it, philosophy is a good thing to look at.
And it's not just the realm of the privileged. I mean, anybody in any position can think philosophically about their predicament and their lives.
No, I would say so. You mentioned Marco Rubio, who was brought around to the value of philosophy by the Stoics. And one of the most famous Stoic writers was Epictetus, who was actually born a slave and came out of slavery and became a philosopher. And so it's certainly true that, you know, if you look at the demographics of philosophy, as when you look at the demographics of any academic field, you'll probably see that people tend to be from backgrounds of relative privilege. But there's definitely nothing intrinsic to the field. Quite the contrary. I think everyone who faces real hard, difficult problems rather than, you know, silly problems about how to spend their myriad leisure hours or which piece of Louis XIV furniture to sit on, those are the people who really benefit from philosophy. They're the people who, you know, need good answers to the questions that they face. So I think that if anything, even though, you know, as a matter of empirical fact, philosophy may tilt towards people who have the time to study it, it's definitely something for the masses.
Well, speaking of which, Terrence, we mentioned Public Philosophy Week starts on Monday in Burlington. Can you give us a taste of what people might experience, anything that you think they should be checking out?
Well, there are a variety of talks given by a variety of people on different topics. I think the aim is to present topics to people in ways that are very accessible, but people will find interesting. Sometimes that'll be a matter of keying into what they're already thinking about. But I think in other cases, it's a matter of bringing topics to their attention that they might not have been thinking about. And we'll find it very interesting to think along with us as we work through some of the issues. They tend to be pretty informal, and they tend to be enjoyable. It's a good group of people. Last year was, I think, a terrific experience seeing ordinary people coming out and thinking philosophical thoughts along with those of us who are trained in the discipline.
Well, we'll put a link up to all of the events on the Public Philosophy Week so you can get inspired if you'd like to attend one yourself at vpr.net. Thank you very much to our two philosophers today, UVM Professor Terrence Cuneo and Dartmouth Professor Kenny Walden. Thanks very much, and I hope the events of next week go well.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.